This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to discuss coverage of Democratic Senators Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema's decisions to kill the Democrats' voting rights legislation. We will also talk about the big money behind voter suppression. Joining us is Ari Berman, senior reporter with Mother Jones covering voting rights. He's the author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari has written two really great pieces that I hope you can take the time to read. The Coming Coup, How Republicans Are Laying the Groundwork to Steal Future Elections, and GOP States Are Shredding Voting Rights, and Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema Are Now Complicit. Hi, Ari. Thanks so much for joining us again.
Hey, Rose. Good to talk to you again. Thank you.
Well, great to have you, Ari. What do you think is next now that the voting rights legislation is dead and the midterms are just around the corner?
Well, it's going to be a long, hard slog to protect voting rights. It's not going to be unprecedented. We've been dealing with this for the past decade, but it's going to be very difficult because what it's going to mean is that you're going to have to challenge voter suppression state by state by state through a number of different tactics, whether it's through the courts, on the ground, through organizing, those kind of things. But none of that's going to be as effective as federal legislation that would have just outlawed so many of these voter suppression tactics overnight, essentially. I mean, Democrats had an unbelievable opportunity to really make the voting system a lot more fair. And because of two Democratic senators, they were not able to. And that's going to have very bad ramifications for democracy. And I think it's also going to have very bad ramifications for the Republican Party, for the Democratic Party, because it's basically giving Republicans a green light to do whatever they want to try to rig the voting system in their favor. And Republicans know it's going to be very hard for Democrats to counteract these measures now.
Ari, what are you hearing about why Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema did this? I mean, it was really incredible to watch what happened on the floor of the Senate after Kyrsten Sinema refused to change the rules. So many Republicans came up to her to shake her hand. It was hard to see who they were because of the masks, but it looked like it was Mitt Romney who even kind of grabbed her arm, basically saying, good job. I mean, what are you hearing about why they did this?
I mean, I'm not sure there's one reason why they did it. I think it was a confluence of factors. I think opposing the Democratic Party and opposing President Biden, Sinema and Manchin think that's good for their brand. I think that they are not big believers in small D democracy. Manchin is allied with coal interests, many powerful interests in his home state. So is Sinema. They are both senators that are very cozy with big money. And one of the things the Freedom to Vote Act would do is crack down on that kind of dark money. And I also don't think that they really see their future long-term in the Democratic Party. And so they've basically said they're not worried about being primaried. And the calculations, I think, are a little bit different for Manchin and Sinema. Manchin represents a state that Joe Biden lost by 40 points. So the Democratic Party doesn't really have any leverage over him. There's a lot more leverage over Sinema because she could easily lose a primary in Arizona, but she's not up till 2024. We don't know what her long-term plans are. So I don't think they felt like it was urgent for them to do this. I don't think they felt like their political careers were going to get derailed if they did this. And I don't think that they thought it hurt their brand. If anything, they might think it helps their brand to be seen as standing up to their party. And I think that all went into the calculation in this.
You know, Robert Reich, who has a lot of experience in D.C. as former labor secretary under President Clinton, sent out a newsletter this morning saying that money plays a big role here. He said, but it's also ego. He says people need to know how D.C. works. You know, a lot of senators do not get that much attention. People want to be on the cable shows, and a lot of people become narcissists. He writes about how some people did not vote for Clinton's healthcare bill because they felt that they didn't get enough attention around it. Now, obviously, Ari, there's no way you can know this, but it's just an interesting kind of insider look at why this stuff happens. He says that Sinema and Manchin are absolutely loving all of the attention they're getting.
Of course, because it gives them so much more leverage that basically the entire agenda has been written to appease Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema. And the amazing thing with the Freedom to Vote Act was that it was Joe Manchin's bill. And that's something that I don't think got enough coverage. This mm-hmm. wasn't Build Back Better. He opposed the For the People Act, the first Democratic voting rights bill. By the way, he supported it in previous Congresses, but when groups like the Chamber of Commerce that he's cozy with mounted a defensive against it, he then opposed the For the People Act. So Democratic senators spent months rewriting the For the People Act with Joe Manchin, and it was his bill. So he essentially was supporting a filibuster of his own bill, which is something that I don't think was noticed or mentioned nearly enough in all of the coverage. I mean, how is it a profile in courage to oppose your own bill? You'd think if anyone would want Joe Manchin's bill to pass, it would be Joe Manchin. Or why did he spend months and months and months trying to write it? And then not only did he spend months writing it, he was given months to negotiate with Republicans. So this idea that there was no outreach to Republicans because Joe Biden didn't call Mitt Romney. Joe Biden didn't need to call Mitt Romney because Joe Manchin was personally trying to meet with senator after senator after senator to get them to support his own bill, and they wouldn't support it. And I think at that point, Democrats hoped Manchin would flip on the filibuster. He would say, listen, I rewrote my bill. I did everything I could to attract Republican support. They won't go for it, so I have no choice. I don't want to do it, but I have no choice but to change the Senate rules to pass this bill because protection of democracy is so vitally important. And he never got there. And that was the strategy, but the strategy just didn't work.
I think that's a great point about media coverage. I also noticed that at least in the cable show world, we didn't really hear that much about what was actually in the bills. And the House recently combined the two bills into one called the Freedom to Vote John Lewis Act. We've had you on so many times, Ari, saying that this bill was just so incredibly important, and it would have basically ensured that people had the right to vote, and it would have superseded some of these laws that have passed to ensure that people do not vote.
Yeah, I mean, the Inside the Beltway media spent almost no time talking about the substance of these bills. They made it all about a Democratic versus Republican fight or an intra-Democratic fight about the filibuster. And they didn't mention the reality of voter suppression. They didn't mention what the bills would have done to stop this. It was entirely personality and tactics focused, the articles they wrote. And I think that's one reason why the bill failed, was because mm-hmm. the media didn't do a good job of educating the public about what it was about and what was in there. And there wasn't a sense of urgency around it. But if you look at what the Freedom to Vote Act would have done, it would have set federal standards for elections so that every state would have basic guarantees of voting access, such as election day and online registration, 2 weeks of early voting, an ability to cast a mail ballot, all of these things that Republican states are cutting back on. The John Lewis Voting Rights Act would have required states with a long history of discrimination to once again approve their voting changes with the federal government. So places like Georgia and Texas that are on the front lines of suppressing voters would have had to once again get federal approval for those changes, which means that their voting laws would have been blocked, at least under this Justice Department and this government. And so these two bills were incredibly important. And basically what the media did is they said, A, they didn't describe the bills at all, or they B, said they don't fix all the problems in the election system. Well, it's hard to fix every single problem. It's hard to stop big live Republicans from running for offices, right? It's hard to stop them from taking over county election boards. It's hard to get the former president of the United States to stop lying. There's only so much you can do through legislation. But I think the bills would have expanded voting access, would have targeted voting discrimination, and also would have got some of these new efforts to subvert fair elections by giving people the right to make sure their vote was counted and making harassment of election officials a crime and doing other things to try to get at election subversion. So these bills were very, very comprehensive. And any kind of solution that emerges, either at the state level or the federal level after this, will not be nearly as consequential, nearly as sweeping, and nearly as effective as these two bills would have been.
And just one example of what we're seeing right now, large urban counties in Texas report that they are rejecting as many as half of all mail ballot applications for the upcoming March primary because of stringent voter ID requirements passed by the GOP-controlled legislature in August. And you argue that the disenfranchisement we're seeing in Texas right now is all too likely to become the norm.
Well, it's really amazing because Texas restricted voting in about 20 different ways when they passed this sweeping voter suppression law at the end of the summer after Texas Democrats fled to D.C. to try to block it and eventually had to come back. And just one part of this law, which is a requirement that you have to have your ID number on your mail-in ballot, is leading to a massive increase in rejected mail ballot applications. And it's because of how the law is written. The law is written in such a way that if you put, let's say, your social security number on your mail ballot application form, but you registered to vote by putting your driver's license number on your registration form, those numbers don't match and your mail ballot is rejected. I mean, that is completely insane, but that's the way the law is written. And people have no idea what number they use when they registered. They just know their IDs now. And so it's leading to a bureaucratic debacle. Election officials under Texas law are prohibited from sending out a mail ballot application to a voter who didn't request one. So unless you specifically request a mail ballot, you cannot even get an application for one in the mail. And this is just an example of how these small, seemingly small bureaucratic changes are going to have a huge impact on elections. And already hundreds of ballots are being flagged. Thousands more could be flagged in 2020. And this is just one provision in one state. And so I think we're going to see a lot more of these kind of things because states change their voting laws very significantly between the last year. And what Republicans said on the floor of the Senate was voter turnout was so high in 2020. Why do we need federal legislation? Ignoring that what Republican states did in 2021 was pass all of these laws precisely so voter turnout would not be as high in future elections.
Ari, what else is happening that really concerns you that's not getting the attention it deserves right now at the state level?
Well, I mean, just a few different things. Number one, as these laws go into effect, we're going to start to see the impact of them. Because remember, we have not seen big elections since Georgia, Florida, Texas, Iowa, et cetera, changed their election laws. So a lot of these laws are going to go into effect for the first time in 2022, and we're going to see the impact of them. Then states are going even further now. So for example, in Georgia, they cut the number of drop boxes dramatically. For example, in Metro Atlanta, they went from having 111 drop boxes to just 23 for four counties in Metro Atlanta, which basically renders them totally useless. Now they want to ban drop boxes altogether. And so we're seeing even more sweeping proposals in the 2022 legislative sessions. But what really disturbs me the most is the new power that some of these states have to actually throw out votes. And the fact that people who say the election was stolen are running for election positions, which the Colorado Secretary of State told me is like giving a robber the key to the bank. People who tried to overturn the 2020 election will be in positions of power or running for key positions in 2022 and 2024. And that's what's most scary, is that people who don't believe in fair elections, they could be your election judge. They could be your county clerk. They could be your Secretary of State. And who knows what they'll do with that authority if they get it.
You report that more than 160 Republican candidates who've amplified the big lie are running for statewide positions with authority over how elections are run. Many more election deniers are running for local positions like poll worker and election judge. And as you report, and we mentioned this on Tuesday, Republicans are not being coy about their intentions. In December, Steve Bannon called for the overthrow of election clerks, saying, "We are going to take over the election apparatus."
This has become the central organizing principle of the right, is to enshrine the big lie into every aspect of the voting system. And what we saw in 2020 was this unprecedented movement to protect voting rights, and so many people volunteering to become poll workers or election workers or sit on local election boards. And a lot of those people have stopped doing this in 2022 because they got burnt out, they're exhausted, or they don't want to deal with the attacks from big lie Republicans. And that's created a void. And the insurrectionists are filling that void. And as Trump said recently, sometimes the vote counter is more important than the candidate. So Republicans have had a single-minded focus to implement what I call an insurrection through other means. They failed to overturn the 2020 election. So they're doing everything they can to rig the outcomes of 2022 and 2024 in their favor. And they're targeting the very things that blocked them. The very things that blocked them from essentially having a coup in 2020 was the fact that you had both Democrats and Republicans who believed in democracy standing up for counting of votes, standing up for certifying elections, standing up for free and fair elections. Those people are now being systematically replaced and purged. And I think that story is not getting nearly enough coverage. And it might be sweeping legal changes that impact the 2022 and 2024 elections, or it might be who's on the county canvassing boards in key places, who are dealing with these key administrative positions, who are the secretaries of state going to be that have to certify the election. All of that kind of thing is where Trump, Bannon, and all of those types are focusing their attention right now.
Today, we're joined by Ari Berman, senior reporter at Mother Jones, author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. Ari, I think the other angle that's not getting much attention is the money behind all of these voter suppression laws and the message that Georgia especially sent to corporate America. So there's a couple things going on here. Why do you call Georgia ground zero? I mean, the fact that Senators Ossoff and Warnock won, and that Biden won Georgia. And we just had someone on from Black Voters Matter who said, look, this didn't just happen. This is years and years of on-the-ground organizing, every day knocking on doors. This didn't just happen. We put so much work and energy into this. Okay, so given those victories, what message do you think that sent the kind of the elite and the corporate America of this class? Of this country.
Well, I think Georgia showed what's at stake. They elected the first Black and the first Jewish senators in state history on January 5th. And that was followed by a vicious, violent white backlash on January 6th. And I thought Reverend Raphael Warnock laid it out very clearly on the Senate floor, the stakes of this debate. America, are we going to be January 5th or are we going to be January 6th? And both things are happening right now in the country, and both things are happening right now in Georgia. You have this incredible progress, this new American majority emerging, and it's being met by a vicious backlash that's taking a number of different forms. But it's no coincidence that Georgia was the state that passed the voter suppression law that became a template for everything Republicans are doing around the country now. Georgia was also the epicenter of the place where Donald Trump tried to overturn the election by telling the Georgia Secretary of State to find 11,780 votes. And it's also a place where election deniers are running for key positions for governor, for Secretary of State, where they're taking over a local election board. So I think the promise of voting rights, but also the attack on voting rights, is present in Georgia more than in almost any other state. And I think that's why it's ground zero for this battle.
Okay, so then let's talk about the money behind these voter suppression laws. In May, you and Nick Sergi ran a piece, leaked video, Dark Money Group brags about writing GOP voter suppression bills across the country. And we're going to hear just a clip from what you found. So just to set this up, just recently on the Senate floor, Democratic Senator Sheldon Whitehouse cited the story you wrote with Nick Sergi. We should say he's director of Documented. In a private meeting last April with big money donors, Jessica Anderson, executive director of Heritage Action for America, a sister organization of the Heritage Foundation, boasted about her meeting with Georgia Governor Brian Kemp just 3 days before the Georgia legislature passed a sweeping voter suppression bill. That is just the beginning. And here is that clip.
Do we think legislature in Georgia got it done? And you can help own this and cheerlead this if you sign it quickly. Do not delay.
But according to the video, Heritage Action did much more than just advocate for the bill.
Iowa was the first state that we got to work in, and we did it quickly and we did it quietly. Honestly, nobody noticed. At the end of the day, the bill that Governor Kemp signed and the Georgia legislature marshaled through had 8 key provisions that Heritage recommended.
This leaked video reveals how Heritage is leading a massive right-wing campaign to suppress voting rights in key battleground states like Georgia, Arizona, Florida, and Iowa just this year.
We're working with these state legislators to make sure they have all of the information they need to draft the bills. In some cases, we actually draft them for them, or we have a sentinel on our behalf give them the model legislation. So it has that grassroots, from the bottom up type of vibe.
That is a clip, and you can read the story at yourcallradio.org. That is Jessica Anderson, Executive Director of Heritage Action for America. Ari, you report that Heritage is spending $24 million over 2 years in 8 battleground states. And then Public Citizen has a report out finding that since 2015, corporations have contributed $50 million to the state lawmakers supporting voter suppression bills. At the top, AT&T, Philip Morris, Comcast, United Health Group, Walmart, and Pfizer. And then they also have a list of all of these organizations that are giving money. Why isn't this angle getting more attention in the national media?
That's a really good question, Rose. I think it was really illustrative that these dark money groups, first they were writing all of the voter suppression bills. Then they led the effort to kill the federal legislation that would have cracked down on dark money and voter suppression. So we saw how two different tactics were intersecting, how the largest dark money groups funded by the biggest corporate actors were then leading the effort to make it harder to vote and fighting the effort that would have stopped it. And I don't think that got enough attention, not just what they were doing, but also how they were targeting Manchin and Sinema. Manchin is very close to a lot of these dark money groups himself. A lot of money was spent in West Virginia. He is very close with groups like the Chamber of Commerce. And I think this was an angle that was missed by the media. In general, what I would say is not just in this issue, but in general, I don't think the media does enough coverage of corruption. This was Build Back Better. Why did Joe Manchin want to kill a bill, for example, that would have led to such huge increases in fighting climate change? What was the money behind that as being a senator from West Virginia? So I think in general, the media doesn't want to acknowledge the corruption that is going on in Washington and the extent to which senators are being bought off, not just Republicans, but some Democrats too. And I think we saw that clearly. They made this a debate about the filibuster, as opposed to a discussion about voter suppression and really an investigation into how these two senators had been systematically bought off by corporate America. And so I think just to look at this as an inside back and forth about the filibuster without looking at all the interests that were trying to sway these senators and who's behind it, that misses a big part of the story.
Right. And the trade groups giving $36 million. For example, Texas for Lawsuit Reform, $901,000. A lot of realtor groups, Iowa Association of Realtors, healthcare organizations, banker organizations giving $35 million to supporters of voter suppression bills. This is from 2015 to 2020.
Yeah. And I mean, we saw this brief moment when there was a backlash to the Georgia law where corporations said, we're going to use our power to fight this kind of thing. And then they did nothing. I mean, it was all complete lip service. What they did is they directed their contributions to the people that were organizing and funding and backing voter suppression laws. And so far from fighting voter suppression after Georgia, they did nothing to fight voter suppression in Florida or in Texas or in the other states that passed these laws after Georgia. And they did nothing to support the federal legislation that would have stopped it. It was all just lip service. It was meant to help the branding of companies as opposed to them getting involved in it. And ultimately, that's not surprising to me. I don't expect corporate America to protect voting rights. That's why I want the U.S. Senate to protect voting rights, okay? We shouldn't expect that AT&T is going to be on the front lines of voter suppression. That's what we elected a Democratic administration to do. And so ultimately, I think the failure of this, I mean, we can criticize corporate America all we want. I think we should, but I think it's ultimately unrealistic to expect that they're going to be the champions of voting rights. The fact that we're relying on businesses to fight voter suppression, to me, just showed the need for federal legislation to protect voting rights in the first place.
Well, and Ari, I mean, so many quotes in your book when we had you on a couple years ago to talk about it stood out for me with Republicans just blatantly saying that they don't want people to vote. Someone just tweeted a quote from Paul Weyrich, the co-founder of Heritage, and I double checked to make sure he said this, and he did. I don't want everybody to vote. As a matter of fact, our leverage in the elections candidly goes up as the voting populace goes down. He said this in 1980. So, I mean, this has been like so many other things. You know, they've spent many years, many decades on these issues.
exactly. That's what I always say is voter suppression has been a long-term project of the Republican Party. It's gotten worse. It's gotten more radical. It's gotten more extreme under Trump, but it's not new. And Republicans didn't vote against the Freedom to Vote Act because they supported the rights of the minority in the Senate. They voted against the Freedom to Vote Act because they're afraid of free and fair elections. They're afraid of the people actually ruling in this country. And they believe, as Paul Ryrick said, that they fare better when fewer people vote. And that has become the central organizing principle of the Republican Party. And I fear that it's going to be very difficult now for Democrats to reverse this by losing their biggest leverage in terms of passing this federal legislation. Not impossible, but I feel like it's going to be much harder than it otherwise would have been to combat the radicalization against democracy of the Republican Party.
We're almost out of time, Ari, but organizers say you cannot organize out of this kind of voter suppression. It's just not possible.
Well, I don't know if it's impossible, but it's not ideal. The federal legislation protecting voting rights would have been far more effective. But I think if the only choice is organizing, you have to organize, that there's no alternative to it right now. And what I will say is that people need to get involved in their own local elections. They need to become poll workers and election judges and county clerks and volunteer for office and run for office, because otherwise the insurrectionists are going to fill the void. And right now, Steve Bannon is recruiting people every single day to fill these critical election positions. If people who care about democracy don't stand up and defend the election system, it is going to fall into the hands of the insurrectionists like they wanted on January 6th.
Ari Berman is senior reporter at Mother Jones and author of Give Us the Ballot, The Modern Struggle for Voting Rights in America. As always, Ari, thank you so much for your great work and thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much, Rose. Great to talk to you again.
Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.